Welcome back to Midpoint, friends, on this May 6th, 2026. I'm thrilled to present our show today with Jason Garcia. He's Florida's leading independent corporate accountability investigative reporter. No one keeps a sharper eye on corruption in Florida and the many ways that businesses and special interests influence public policy to put profits over people. Jason will be with us in a couple of minutes after a brief review of the biggest political news of the week. Well, as of today, the Florida legislature, they concluded their special session on congressional redistricting that ran from April 28th to May 1st, and they concluded it with a giant, great big FU to Florida voters. They passed a mid-decade redistricting map that completely flouts and violates the Florida Fair District's constitutional amendment that the voters, you know, you and me, worked so hard to pass in 2010. The amendment was supposed to prevent the sort of partisan carving up of the state to protect the congressional seats of one party that this redistricting will absolutely cause. In other words, the Republican-controlled legislature's new map has created voting districts that will send only Republicans to represent us in Congress. All the few and far between formerly heavily Democratic districts, like District 14 in Democratic Tampa and St. Petersburg, where the voters elected Democrat Kathy Castor 7 times since 2013, well, now those type of districts have been carved up and those voters have been divided to ensure that no more than a very few Democrats around the state, if any, can be elected to represent the 1/3 of all registered voters in the state of Florida who are registered Democrats. The legislature did this by carving up the Democratic districts so that the votes of Democrats are now diluted by overwhelming numbers of Republicans in the new districts. This is exactly the sort of partisan redistricting that the Fair Districts Amendment was designed to prevent. Our representatives in Congress are supposed to represent the interests and concerns of their voters. But how can they when the voters in their district no longer share the same interests and concerns? For example, the city of Tampa is now chopped up into 3 congressional districts, District 12, 14, and 15. And the urban voters of Tampa and St. Petersburg are now lumped in with the voters of 3 more rural, distant, and majority red counties whose interests are, well, let's face it, completely different from those of the city dwellers. And voting districts are supposed to have a sensible relationship to existing geographic boundaries, and now they won't. For example, again, in the city of Tampa, City Hall is in one district and the city police station is in another. Seminole Heights and Tampa Heights are also carved up, and those neighborhoods are now placed into 3 different districts. The idea of people being represented in Congress by a person who shares the interests and priorities of his or her constituents is just no longer operating. Now, the politicians have picked their voters instead of the people, the voters, picking their politicians. And the governor has given the Republicans likely 4 more Republicans in Congress. I'm deeply interested in what happens with the redistricting because, well, full disclosure, I am now a named plaintiff representing District 14 in one of the lawsuits challenging the legality of this redistricting. A lawsuit has been filed by lead plaintiff's Equal Opportunity Education Fund, represented by attorney Mark Elias, who is the foremost Democratic-aligned voting rights lawyer in the country. This lawsuit challenges the gerrymandering of the Florida districts because the maps use partisan intent to favor Republicans, and the redistricting violates the rules against diminishing minority voting power. There are 2 other lawsuits that challenge the redistricting on other and similar grounds. The Campaign Legal Center lawsuit targets the maps as a violation of state constitutional grounds. They fail to meet the compactness requirements for districts, and they violate the rules against partisan gerrymandering. Similar claims are made in the lawsuit filed just yesterday by the Southern Poverty Law Center on behalf of Common Cause, the League of Women Voters of Florida, and the League of United Latin American Citizens. So unless the courts say otherwise and do it quickly, the governor's new maps will apply to the 2026 midterm elections. The redistricting would likely eliminate four Democratic seats and give the Republicans four more seats in Congress. I'm sure we will talk more about this seismic change in Florida politics with Jason Garcia in a minute. Meanwhile, the legislature is scheduled to return for another special session next week to finalize the state budget, with additional discussions on property tax cuts expected in June. We'll see what other havoc they can wreak on the state then. Right now, you are listening to Midpoint on WMNF Tampa at 88.5 FM. Let me bring investigative reporter Jason Garcia into the conversation now. He's with us on Zoom from his newsroom in the Orlando area, where he conducts deeply researched investigations into Florida corruption and graft and the influence of business and special interests on policymaking. He publishes his Substack and his newsletter, Seeking Rents, to tell us all about it. So welcome to Midpoint, Jason.
Hey there. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to do this.
Well, great. I'm happy to have you back with us. We try to bring you in at the end of every legislative session to tell us and explain what just happened.
For a postmortem.
Yes, exactly. So where should we begin this time? Well, how about staying with the redistricting for a bit? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I think to the point you made, it is a pretty seismic shift. And there's two things that are significant about this. There's the sort of the national political implications, where this is part of a national effort. It was begun by the Trump White House with Texas, and then they tried to get other states to go along, including Indiana, where it didn't work, although that played out differently in primary elections last night.
Yeah, just yesterday.
But, you know, the Trump White House is looking ahead to congressional midterm elections this year. And, you know, historically, midterms are challenging for the party that controls the White House. And this is looking like a particularly significant anti-Trump election. You know, who knows what will happen between now and then. But they are looking at the threat of losing not only the House of Representatives, but potentially the Senate. And so they set out essentially trying to create themselves a voter-proof majority in the U.S. House.
That's a good way to put it, a voter-proof majority.
Right. Republican-controlled states redistrict to re-gerrymander and gerrymander more aggressively in favor of Republicans. And, of course, that has touched off a race to the bottom where we've seen Democratic-controlled states respond in kind, places like California and Virginia. And so we're quickly devolving into this place where any party that controls both the governor and the legislature in their state is going to try and gerrymander themselves to like complete control of their congressional delegation rather than one that kind of reflects the mix of the state. And so what you saw with these Florida maps is they're designed to take what had been an already gerrymandered 20-8 Republican majority in the state's congressional delegation and make it a 24-4 majority. They're eliminating Democratic-held seats around Orlando, Tampa, and two in South Florida. And so just on the national political level, if they are able to make a full four-seat swing here, and we should say it's probably unlikely that they will get all four seats this year, given the way things are shaping up.
Yeah, that's one of the points I wanted to ask you about. Yeah. You know, we covered this issue during the debates over the redistricting before it actually happened. And there was a lot of talk about the fact that if they went ahead and did this, it could be what some people called the dummy mander,
right,
where it backfired on them because a number of Republican incumbents would now be placed into districts where they didn't know those voters and they were risking, you know, potentially losing their seat to a Democrat. Do you think, you know, and for that matter, in this vote to pass this gerrymandered new map, these gerrymandered new maps, five Republicans in the Florida legislature actually voted against it,
right,
probably worried, you know, about their seats. And I wonder, do you think that the Dems could actually prevail under these new maps in at least some of the redistricted areas?
Yeah, I think, you know, the folks that study this kind of stuff, like, you know, that rate House ratings and stuff like that, all seem to agree that there is a little bit of risk to Republicans here. Although, you know, generally speaking, relatively moderate risk of it actually being a dummy mandering. You know, so for it to be a dummy mander, they would have to lose more than four seats, right? Like they would have to go from 20 to 8 to like, you know, 19 to 9 or something. They'd have to lose where they are now. More than likely, folks seem to think Republicans are very likely to win one or two of these, one or two or even three of these new seats this year. So they might not get the full four-seat swing, but they'll still probably pick up one, two, or three seats out of this map. So that's not necessarily a gerrymander. But you're right that going into session...
You mean a dummy mander.
Yeah. And you're right that going into session, there was a lot of pushback from like existing Republican incumbent members of Congress in Florida who did not want to do this because as you to make more Republican districts, you've got to spread more Democratic voters out. You know, you normally think of gerrymandering as you're trying to create like if you're the Republican Party, you're trying to create as many 60-40 Republican districts as possible and then a handful of like 95-5 Democratic districts, right? But to make more Republicans, you got to put those Democratic voters somewhere, and it makes. You know, a lot of Republican incumbents were worried about their seats becoming potentially vulnerable under this process. And they were able to avoid that in part by the other big part of this session. The big storyline out of this is they just openly defied the anti-gerrymandering provisions in the Constitution, what are known as the Fair Districts Amendments, which you alluded to. They made no secret of the fact that these maps were drawn in direct defiance of these. The governor's office took the position unilaterally that the Fair Districts Amendments are unconstitutional, and so we do not have to be bound by them. The legislature does not have to be bound by them, and they passed these maps. The whole point of this, in addition to setting up to creating a larger Republican majority, is to set up a conflict where they are counting on the Florida Supreme Court to invalidate entirely the Fair District Amendments, to rule them unconstitutional under the U.S. Constitution. And that would be just a phenomenal poke in the eye to Florida voters, who, again, nearly two-thirds of voters supported these amendments. And they are actively trying to kill the amendments with these maps.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things that I'm really concerned about. Because, excuse me, just last week, the United States Supreme Court ruled in the Calais case to gut the Voting Rights Act, the Federal Voting Rights Act, because the sections that pertain to race, saying that that was unconstitutional. And now it seems like our state attorney general and the governor have taken the position that because the Fair Districts Amendment in Florida contains sections pertaining to race, preventing the state from gerrymandering the districts to prevent minority voters from having the opportunity to get a representative of their choice. Now they feel, I think, emboldened because of that United States Supreme Court decision to come out and say that all the entirety of the Fair District Amendments are unconstitutional, rather than maybe possibly severing out the race portion and keeping the you can't gerrymander for partisan reasons portion. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that you're right. That is absolutely the argument. So the argument being that the Civil Rights Act, the provisions relating to sort of like preserving minority access districts, congressional districts, are unconstitutional, and because the Fair District Amendments includes language saying like you essentially it was designed to say you've got to comply with the U.S. Constitution in addition to not drawing districts that favor partisan that consider partisan interests or try to favor a political party, but because the Fair District Amendment includes that provision, they're saying the whole thing is unconstitutional.
Right.
That because this federal law, they have taken the position is unconstitutional, this means this state law, which goes way beyond that and deals with different things and would be very easy to sever if you wanted to comply in good faith with it. It is entirely possible to comply with the Supreme Court and still comply with the Florida State Supreme Court or the Florida State Constitution and draw districts that aren't intentionally designed to favor one party over another or protect incumbents. The challenge they will face, so if you're trying to handicap how things go, that U.S. Supreme Court ruling didn't go as far as they wanted. You're right that it had the effective impact of gutting these provisions of the Voting Rights Act, but they didn't actually declare them completely unconstitutional. They still left some wiggle room for where they could be interpreted constitutionally, particularly as it relates to not diluting existing districts that were created for reasons of responding to direct prejudice and racism and stuff like that. But because they did not just completely throw it out, that obviously makes the argument that we have to throw out the Fair Districts Amendment because it includes this a tie to this amendment. That makes that argument a lot harder to make in court. The flip side here is you're dealing with a Florida Supreme Court where the governor has now appointed 6 of the 7 members.
The Florida Supreme Court is a wholly owned subsidiary of DeSantis, yeah, Inc. It really is. And, yeah, you know, one of the things that struck me about this whole situation is that the governor and his henchman, James Uthmeyer, the attorney general, have made this decision unilaterally without even the a court in Florida passing on the issue of whether or not the Fair Districts Amendment needs to be adhered to anymore. I mean, they're just doing it because they say so. They're making an interpretation, a constitutional interpretation, about the Florida Constitution, and they're saying that, you know, we're the authority. We don't have to abide by fair districts, and so, you know, we're going to gerrymander these districts before the next election. This is not the first time that Uthmeyer has taken that authority on his shoulders, right? I mean, back in January, on Martin Luther King Day of all days, he issued a legal opinion that nobody asked for, in which he declared that his office would no longer enforce more than 80 state laws on the books that were meant to address harms caused by historic discrimination, racial discrimination. And so I guess Uthmeyer doesn't believe we ever had any racial discrimination, and he believes that he is the ultimate authority on Florida constitutional issues. Not a court, but him. That has really, you know, set me off. I mean, talk about that a little bit from your perspective.
This is actually what you're describing there, this essentially self-initiated opinion where he says right in the opinion, I requested of myself an opinion on whether or not these laws are constitutional, which, by the way, aren't just about there aren't laws that require laws that require action to undo the effects of like racial discrimination. Some are just laws dealing with studying it and counting it and making sure we like understand what impacts have been. They want to unenforce. They don't want to even look to see if racial discrimination still is having an impact with these. But what is really dangerous about this is, you know, there's kind of a technicality, corny element to this that is potentially actually illegal, but then there's also a macro thing that is really dangerous, and that is, just on the macro thing, there is a long-standing principle in government, constitutional principle, that executive officers cannot challenge the constitutionality of laws passed by the legislature or constitutional provisions adopted by legislatures or voters, right? That their job is to execute the law. You don't
execute the will of the voters, right?
Yeah, and you think about it this way. We can't have a situation where, for instance, like every police chief or every mayor is taking a different interpretation of the law. So executive officers are forbidden from challenging constitutionally or making constitutional determinations themselves unilaterally. But that's exactly what James Uthmeyer, the appointed attorney general, Ron DeSantis' former chief of staff, by the way, did. And the way he sort of wiggled himself into doing it is this absurd ask himself for an opinion, right?
Right.
It is an enormous violation of legal norms for an executive officer like that to unilaterally stop enforcing laws because he, not a court, he deemed them unconstitutional. And just to sort of elaborate on just sort of the total lack of disregard for the law in something like this. I mentioned there was kind of like a technicality that's a little bit more corny, but sort of reveals to how little they care about this. You know, there is actually a statute on the books where local government officials can ask the attorney general for an opinion if they're unsure of what their obligations are under the law. That's the statute he used there. And just he was the government official asking himself what his duties were. Although for just a second, pause and ask yourself, how genuinely uncertain could James Uthmeyer have been about his duties that he needed to ask James Uthmeyer the right answer was, right? It's just
it's absurd. It's absurd. And I wonder, you know, whether any local official has to abide by his opinion in these circumstances.
You know, when you're dealing with the broad constitutional power where the governor can suspend you for virtually any reason that he deems, then, yeah, it's
yeah,
interesting to go
that, against. But that brings me to the issue of how does this compare with the removal of our state attorney, our local state attorney in Hillsborough County, Andrew Warren. Andrew was removed for stating that he'd be unlikely to enforce laws permitting the prosecution of women seeking abortion when those laws didn't even exist yet. I mean, he didn't actually do anything. You know, right. He gave a statement of opinion, and he was removed. We didn't even have any abortion laws like that at the time, so there was nothing to not enforce. And yet here's Uthmeyer refusing to enforce existing laws.
Yeah, the only difference there is Uthmeyer tried to do this cutesy, I'm asking myself for an opinion. So he tried to follow some process. Although to the point of that, the law allows for elected officials, for executive officers to ask for opinions, but they got to do it in writing. And guess what? He didn't do it in writing. I made a public records request for the letter James Uthmeyer wrote to himself to get this opinion out of
Dear James.
they dragged it out for 3 months. At one point, they even claimed, we're working on it. We promise you, we're working on it. When finally I told them I was going to write a story about why on earth it was taking 3 months to turn over a request to himself, they finally fessed up. He never actually did it. And they claimed he didn't have to abide by this law. So not only is he doing this like spiritually illegal thing by refusing to execute laws without actually going through the court system, he's literally like ignoring like the letter of the law that says if you're going to do this, you got to do the request in writing.
Yeah, wow. It's just such an enormous overreach. The way that, I mean, of course it's an echo of the regime in power in Washington, but this enormous overreach of executive power that is just, it's extraordinary, and it's so dangerous. I mean, it's so dangerous when you think about the fact that they are taking positions on laws without going through the courts, and then they're enforcing those positions.
And not only that, remember, James Uthmeyer is the guy that a federal court ruled in contempt of court because he defied court orders in the case related to the immigrant detention facility, to an immigration law, enforcing state immigration laws. This was a different case than the Everglades facility. But he was found in contempt of court for openly defying a federal court order. This is like, I mean, you're talking about what is getting pretty close to a lawless attorney general.
Yeah. I mean, this is fascism, really. I mean, he's taken ultimate power unto himself. I talk about that pretty much every week, ad nauseum, really, about how close to a fascist regime Florida has become. And Uthmeyer, I think, is the poster boy for that, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, certainly if you think of fascism in the context of for my friends everything, for my foes the law, there is, like, when you consider the unequal application of the law to James Uthmeyer versus Andrew Warren or Monique Worrell in Orlando.
Yeah.
You know, certainly the glove seems to fit. And let's not forget, by the way, this is the same guy that was at the dead center of the Hope Florida scandal.
Right? Oh, yes.
This is a scandal in which the DeSantis administration, led by then Chief of Staff James Uthmeyer, took $10 million of Medicaid settlement money and seems to have turned it into campaign ads paid for by paid through a political committee controlled by James Uthmeyer.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, These are not guys with long track records of faithfully adhering to the law in Florida.
You know, he came to Tampa a couple weeks ago and spoke at the Tiger Bay Club, and I asked him, you know, something to the effect of, why haven't you requested the release? Can you tell us if you testified before the grand jury and took the fifth, and if you can't tell us that, why haven't you requested the release of the Hope Florida grand jury report? Because he could do that. It's true that grand jury reports are secret, but a court can release it in the interest of justice. And
this isn't my expertise, but I don't believe it's true that presentments are secret. They're only secret when someone named in them is filing objections to them, right? Like,
well, that's federal. In Florida, right, They're pretty much secret, but he could, as the attorney general of the state of Florida, who's responsible for the administration of justice in Florida, he could ask a court, you know, to release the report. And, you know, I mean, this is a matter of great public interest, and the court has the authority to release it in the interest of justice. I mean, of all people, he should be concerned about the interests of justice in Florida.
For a guy who keeps insisting and has been for a year that there's nothing to see here, he's sure vested in making sure nobody actually looks over there.
Right, right. All right. Well, let's move on because we don't have enough time for all the things that I want to talk to you about. But let's talk about the Florida Save Act. You know, DeSantis signed this restrictive elections bill, and he was immediately sued in federal court by voting rights groups who contend that the new law is unconstitutional. The Florida Save Act, the Voting Act, the elections, new elections law, according to the federal lawsuit, it focuses specifically on the provisions of the law that will require Florida voters to prove their U.S. citizenship by producing more documents, such as a birth certificate or an active passport. And if you are, for instance, a woman who has changed her last name after marriage, the official documentation of that name change has to be produced too. So this kind of, you know, show us your papers provision will apply to new voters registering to vote for the first time and to existing voters who update their voter registration because of a name change, an address change, or a party change. Or voters who get tagged by state officials in Tallahassee as potentially ineligible to vote. So another part of this bill reduces the types of photo IDs that already registered voters can now show when they arrive at the polling place to vote. The big issue here is that college and university students, for instance, will no longer be permitted to use their student IDs. This is so clearly an attempt to suppress student voter turnout, although I should point out that this law will take effect after the November elections. It'll take effect in 2027. But still, I mean, this is clearly an attempt to suppress the vote.
Yeah, you're right. You're talking about actually two different provisions. There is the kind of, like you said, the show me your papers provision where new voters changing or updating their registration, or again, the most dangerous part of the bill, voters that just get identified by Tallahassee. Like you could envision a world where suddenly, like, every voter whose name ends with an EZ is suddenly identified as potentially ineligible to vote.
Yes.
Or something like that they will have to produce these documents. And, you know, again, it generally comes down to an active passport or a birth certificate. And when you start to sort of game through that situation, you start to see who really gets impacted. You're talking about young people, like college students who don't live close to home and might not have access.
How about naturalized citizens whose birth certificates are in another country?
Sure, you're going to have to produce your certificate papers or your naturalization certificate. You mentioned this is a big issue potentially for women who have changed their name as a result of marriage or divorce, right? Where you're going to have to go find official documentation of those court proceedings to change your name. It's an enormous issue. This is something I wasn't aware of until listening to some of the debate. For like elderly Black people, there are a number of like older Black voters who were not born in hospitals because of, you know, issues of structural racism at the time and discrimination, and were never issued birth certificates, right? So mm-hmm. they've got to go track these. And when you actually operationalize it, when like people might not know until they go to vote that they've been deemed ineligible, they have to prove this, and suddenly you're on a very tight time to turn this stuff around.
Good point.
That's where it potentially impacts people. The second piece you're talking about is, I think, probably less significant in terms of the impact it will have, but is even more blatant because they not only could not provide a justification for it, they continued to change their justification. And this is, they will no longer allow university students to use their student IDs as their picture ID when they show up to vote. Again, we are not talking about registration. That's already happened in this process. We're talking about the ID you show when you go to your polling place. You just have to show that you're the person that's on the list of already registered, right? They took away student IDs as an option. Well, by the way, leaving like a concealed firearm license is still a valid form of ID, but your student ID. And they were so determined to get rid of student IDs. There's actually a catch-all provision in law that says basically any form of picture government ID issued by a government is a valid form of ID for when you show up at the polling place. And so, like, if you work for a public employer, your employee ID can be used. They went into that statute and wrote it. It said any form of ID issued by a government is valid unless that government is an educational institution.
Yeah.
And when they were pressed on this, so in the House sponsor, this a rep by the name of Jenna Persons Mullica, a Republican from Southwest Florida, when she was asked, why are we doing this? She had no answer. She was like, I just decided to do it. And then when it came up in the Senate, Aaron Grawl, a Republican from Vero Beach, carried this bill. Then she claimed, well, I was worried that student IDs are more easily counterfeited than other forms of ID. And it's like, oh, what makes you say that? Do you have any evidence of that? No, none whatsoever. Can you name a single example of it happening? No. And then when Ron DeSantis signed it, he talked about it and how these IDs don't tell you you're a Florida resident. But again, this is not for registration.
Right. These students are registered.
They've already proven a residency.
Yeah.
This is 100% a pure...
Okay. We know the reason. We know the reason.
Right.
I mean, this is because they understand that women and students, women and young people, are more likely to vote Democratic. This is just a voter suppression effort. That's all it is. Let's be honest, right? Tell it like it is, as they used to say.
Let's say it this way. They were, particularly when it comes to the student ID piece, they were never able to provide a single rationale that stood up to any scrutiny. On the documentation stuff, the citizenship documentation, the talking point was, you're not allowed to vote. We want to make sure non-citizens aren't allowed to vote. We want to put teeth on that.
Yeah.
You know, you can argue that there's no evidence that this is a problem and that the headaches, the number of valid eligible voters who will be disqualified by what is essentially extra bureaucracy, outweighs the harm. But at least there's a rationale to that. There was no rationale. They could articulate no reason for the student ID piece.
Really? All right. You're listening to Midpoint on WMNF Tampa. And today we are talking with independent investigative reporter Jason Garcia, who publishes the Substack and podcast Seeking Rents, about all of the developments and new laws that came out of the 2026 Florida legislative sessions. So, okay, let me move on to this topic that I have spent a lot of time talking about on this show over the weeks of the legislative session, and that's the domestic terrorist organization law, the law that gives the governor and the cabinet the power to secretly designate civil rights groups as terrorist organizations and potentially to punish people who support them. We discussed this one a lot, both before and when it passed, but I'd like your take on it.
Yeah, this is, in my mind, there were three particularly, there are kind of three big bad bills that passed this year, and this is one of them. There's another really aggressive union-busting bill that passed, and there was... I'm forgetting the third big bad bill. Oh, the elections bill. We just talked about it.
Yeah.
This one is probably unlike anything we have seen in terms of the amount of power it is giving the governor and also the cabinet. So these designations have to be approved by the cabinet. But the power to designate a domestic terrorist organization, which is something the federal government has rejected in the past as a designation, and then to impose sanctions that can take effect even before there's any kind of like litigation around whether or not the designation is valid, right? Like it's an incredible sort of cart before the horse, criminal justice potential punishment. And the law, the big concern in this debate was just how vague it is, because you mentioned there's the organization itself, and everybody knows they are going immediately after Islamic and Muslim organizations.
Yeah, let's point out that DeSantis issued an executive order declaring CARE, the Council on Arab
Islamic Relations.
Islamic Relations, American Islamic Relations. I'm sorry, I didn't get that right. The Council on American Islamic Relations and the Muslim Brotherhood domestic terrorist organization. He declared that by executive order and declared that basically anybody who supported them or
promotes them
was subject to losing any sort of state benefits or anything. I don't think there was any sort of criminal consequences on that. But in any event, CARE sued and they got an injunction and that executive order was essentially voided. And so he went to the legislature and he got them to put it into law. And that's where we are now. It did. It passed the legislature. He signed it. Now it's a law.
That's right. And I think there's a legal challenge going to it. But you're right that, in fact, I think this was the Tampa Bay Times broke this story. But that this law comes straight from the governor's office, right? They wanted this power for themselves, right? The only kind of check the legislature put on it was they made the designation have to be the entire cabinet. But, you know, remember, the cabinet is three people, right? It's the attorney general, the chief financial officer, and the agriculture commissioner. Ron DeSantis appointed two of the three cabinet members right now.
Right. And you know, the other thing that struck me about this is that this designation is created in secret. Like, there's no opportunity for due process to the organization to challenge the designation.
Yeah, the opportunity to challenge comes after the designation has already taken effect and when sanctions can already have taken effect.
Right.
Everybody knows that the end game here is they're going to use this to try and take vouchers away, for instance, from Islamic schools.
Yep.
But then you're in a situation where we're going to be providing taxpayer money for vouchers to Christian schools and to Jewish schools, but not to Islamic schools. That the sort of the constitutional rabbit holes you end up going down because of a law like this, it'll obviously get challenged immediately, but like, even the application of it, every time it gets applied, there's going to be just enormous constitution. Because you're, again, all of this ultimately rests on like ideology, right? It doesn't require actions that are prompting these designations. You know, it's like based on ideology. And so, yeah, this is a.
And how far does the removal of state benefits go? Like, does that mean that anybody who has a state job, I mean, if you're, I don't know, you know, you work on state roads or something. You work for a contractor who's been hired by the state. Does that mean you're going to lose your job? I mean,
well, as we've already sort of discussed in a couple of contexts, we're dealing with a governor and an attorney general who don't seem to feel bound by the written letter of the law in any way. So, you know, however far you think they could extend it, they'll probably extend it even further.
Yeah, right. All right. Okay, moving on. Let's talk about the Palm Beach Airport. They just changed the name of the Palm Beach International Airport in West Palm Beach to the President Donald J. Trump International Airport. And let's talk about the grift involved with this name change, because it is always, always and forever about the grift. Let's talk about that.
Right. And also, let's talk about the irony of a legislative session where the one bill they had to pass, the budget, they failed to do. But they did manage to pass not one, not two, but three bills naming things after Donald Trump. You've got Donald J. Trump International Airport in Palm Beach now, which is right in front of that will go the President Donald J. Trump Highway, which will run from Palm Beach all the way to the West Coast in Fort Myers. And that's just a little north of President Donald J. Trump Boulevard in Fort Lauderdale. So three bills to name stuff after Donald Trump. But you're right. I think This legislation was changed midway through the session. Initially, it renamed the airport this, but then to require Palm Beach County to enter into a licensing agreement with the rights holder to the name of President Donald J. Trump International Airport. And wouldn't you know it, that happened immediately after one of Donald Trump's businesses trademarked the rights to that name. So and I believe the county just approved a licensing agreement. And what this does now, it does require that they provide the name royalty free. It does not prohibit any sort of royalty sharing. It does not prohibit Donald Trump taking all the resources that will go into updating the airport and designing new logos. And we should talk about the resources that will go into this. It does not prohibit him from profiting off those by selling merchandise and stuff related to that. So it is.
And nobody else can sell the merchandise either. It has to be his licensed merchandise, right?
That's right, because the trademark. That's exactly right. And he's applied the trademark to like all manner of merchandise. So this is so clearly, in addition to being a vanity play to a guy who's just like got an insatiable appetite for genuflection and worship, but it is also a money-making venture, like everything out of this White House seems to be. And I think it's really important that folks know that this isn't just let Donald Trump go make a few extra bucks off this public airport. Taxpayers are going to spend money on this. The legislature is going to put $5.5 million of taxpayer money into the state budget to hang a bunch of signs, to design new logos, these new logos that will then go on the golf shirts that Donald Trump is going to sell, right? We're going to spend $5.5 million to put this into place. Like, this is not a painless or a costless exercise, right?
Yeah, it's not free to the Florida taxpayers.
That's right.
It's going to cost us. Well, you know, Bobby Bowden, the football coach, he got an airport named after him, too. Does he get the same kind of benefit?
You know, it's a little funny story about that. I've been pulling records out of the Florida legislature, and I had asked for some records related to the governor's office's work this session. And one of the things I found is the Bobby Bowden airport naming came from the governor's office late in session. Because for folks that don't know, I mentioned there was a bill renaming or creating the President Donald J. Trump Highway, this 120-mile State Road 80 running from Palm Beach to Fort Myers. Right near the end of the process, they threw into this bill, we're also going to call the Tallahassee Airport the Coach Bobby Bowden Tallahassee Airport. That came from the governor's office. And I think that was entirely so when he signed the bill, he could just talk about the Bobby Bowden stuff.
Right.
He did a big signing ceremony where that's all he talked about. Never mentioned that, like, oh, yeah, we got a 120-mile highway named after Trump in this same bill. I think this was to give him a reason to sign this bill and a way to avoid talking about Donald Trump while he did it.
Wow. All right. Well, I think we have to talk about what's coming up next, and that's the budget. I want your thoughts on what you think is going to come out of this budget, because, you know, developing a budget is as much a political statement as, you know, dollars and cents. It's a political priorities statement. And I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are about what they're going to do with this budget.
Yeah, I think one of the things to watch is the budget, in addition to, so there's enormous differences to be resolved over spending. So just to give you one example that's significant, the Florida Senate budget has $50 million that is essentially for the Tampa Rays baseball stadium. It's essentially to give to Hillsborough Community College to do infrastructure upgrades and stuff to accommodate a new stadium on site. And that's something Ron DeSantis really wants.
But who has the $50 million? Because I read...
The Senate has the 50
The Senate.
Million.
Yeah, but the House has zero, right? The House, has zero.
Yeah. So you're going to see lots of fights like that. And to the point of the politics of it, so much of that is about will be about the bad relationship between the House Speaker and the governor, right? And so, like, so much of the budget tension right now resolves around the Senate, which has, like, hugged itself as tightly as possible to the governor, wants to give the governor everything he wants, including things like money for the Rays Stadium, and money essentially for the Rays Stadium.
Yeah, and, you know, Tampa's caught in the middle of this because, really, they want to destroy all of Hillsborough College, and they want the Rays want the decision to go ahead with funding before there's any resolution over the money to rebuild the college.
Right. But even beyond sort of all these spending decisions, and there are enormous ones that are they're even more consequential, right? Like, there's, you know, to be fair to the governor, he's been on the right side of wanting as much money as possible for Everglades restoration, and that's a fight that needs to be resolved. So there's lots of those spending decisions, but also what we have seen in the past, particularly out of this governor and legislature, is that they use the budget as a vehicle to pass really controversial legislation at the last moment with as little scrutiny as possible. So folks might remember last year we had the same sort of budget situation where the legislature failed to pass a budget for several months, right? We went into like...
Which is their one constitutional requirement,
right?
That you have one job, legislature, you got to pass a budget.
You are constitutionally required to pass one budget, and you don't have to pass any bills naming things after Donald Trump.
Right.
But, you know, who knows what you're going to do? But last year, at the very last minute, when they finally finished the budget on day 105 of the 60-day legislative session, they crammed in a giant Schools of Hope expansion.
Yes.
Remember that one.
Yeah, we talked about that too here.
That was a bill that surfaced at the last moment. So we need to be on guard. And there was lots of different things like that showed up into the budget last year. Like, there was money to pay a new Ron DeSantis appointed president of FAMU. There was provisions in there to help Newsmax, the far right cable news network, right? All this stuff just showing up at the last minute. And so we need to be on guard for that kind of thing. So one of the stories we've wrote on the newsletter was there was an attempt that died this session to essentially purge the state's Medicaid rolls. This came from the governor's office, we learned, and the governor was pushing a plan that would have kicked as many as 100,000 Floridians off of their health insurance. That did not pass in session, but this is absolutely the sort of thing that you could see lying in wait and suddenly surface at the last minute as part of the budget. So there's all of these major policy issues that when people hear budget, they think just spending, but right. No, the way the governor and the legislature use the budget, there's just enormous consequences all across the state where they could stitch it to the budget at the last minute.
All right, I've got one more issue, and then we've got a call here I want to take, but quickly, this culture law that forbids local governments from supporting diversity or inclusion programs, are we going to lose our Pride month? Are we going to lose our Caribbean culture festivals? What about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the real danger with a law like this, which is another one of these laws that is very vaguely written and by the way, implicitly empowers the governor to suspend local elected officials who he deems have violated this really vague ban on.
That's the kicker in this law, right?
And so what you're going to get into a situation is there's going to be a lot of elected officials who are just leery of supporting any of these because they're unsure on where the governor is going to land, right? And, you know, if it's something, you know, the governor supports, you probably won't think twice about it. But if it's, you know, a pride festival, like, I don't want to suspend it over that. So there's this law, the real danger in a law like this is essentially what is going to be over voluntary compliance from folks that are really worried about being suspended, not even realizing they violated it. And where you'll, I mean, if to be honest, where we can all be honest that where you'll really see this impact is on events for impacting the LGBTQ community and Black community.
Right.
You know, those are the primary targets. Those are the ones that the governor is going to particularly come after, right?
Yeah. All right. I've got a call here. I want to wrap up and talk a little bit more about what you're working on and how your, how your newsroom works. I've got a call here from Chris in Gainesville. Let me bring him on. He's got some questions about that. Chris, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you for holding. I'm sorry you had to hold.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I was listening all along. I really appreciate what Jason Garcia is doing and wanted to know what the business model is, how it can be better supported, and who is supporting it. Are the schools of journalism involved with you, or are you involved with them? For instance, our College of Journalism here in Gainesville at UF. And to find out more about that, and also to say I look forward to meeting you at the meet and greet in Orlando the day after tomorrow, or Saturday.
Hey.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for bringing that up, Chris. I'm going to take you off there and let Jason respond to you. Don't forget to mention that those in-person events that you've got coming up.
Yeah. I can't wait. Yeah. So we've got, this is the first time I'm doing live events. I'm teaming up with actually Craig Pittman and Chad Charland, who do the Welcome to Florida podcast. I'm sure you know Craig. It's like a legendary.
Yeah, we've had Craig on the show, of course.
Yeah, so we're going to do an event tomorrow at Tombolo Books in St. Petersburg, and then Saturday at Austin's Coffee in Winter Park. And first, let me say thank you to the caller for the kind words and asking that question. So I publish on Substack, and everything I do, all the stories I write, the podcasts I do, I make free to everybody. But we do have a voluntary paid subscription, and that's where I generate most of my revenue is from voluntary paid subscribers. So, like, every story I write, every podcast I do, I make sure to make a call that, like, for folks that that have the means, please consider paying to support our work, because ultimately it relies on the support of our readers. I do work with other journalists. So, like, one of the missions I set when I started Seeking Rents, and for folks that don't know, Seeking Rents is, it's not about apartments. It's a term in economics about, called rent seeking.
You should explain that, rent seeking.
Yeah.
What it is.
Rent seeking is what's happening when someone with lots of wealth and influence uses their wealth and influence to get laws changed in their favor in a way that allows them to capture even more wealth and influence for themselves, usually at the expense of someone else. So, like, my whole mission is calling that out and exposing that where I can, particularly in state government. But I do work with reporters at outlets across the state. I try and help folks with public records requests. I do a lot of what I do because I've been doing this for so long is obtaining public records, making requests. Any records I get, I share with other journalists. I want folks to have access to these materials and writing stories as best I can. I speak to journalism schools. I speak to legal clinics. I speak to as many community groups as I can. The goal is both to do as much investigative journalism as I can, but also to help others do the same thing and to magnify. I sort of sometimes joke that Seeking Rents is meant to be like a force magnifier for Florida journalism, right? Like I'm basically like an old newsroom dinosaur that's available to sort of just share wisdom and stuff like that. But you know what it really comes down to for support is folks paying for their subscriptions, and you know.
But you don't gatekeep it though. I mean, you can still read Seeking Rent Substack.
The issue and the origin story of that is, you know, I spent a lot of time covering the ghost candidate scandal. For folks that don't remember that, there was an election scheme to try South Florida and Central Florida. And at the time, I was working for the Orlando Sentinel, and we got way ahead of a lot of other people in that story, to the point where others had sort of like given up. And so like we were able to sort of show that all this dark money being used to advertise these quote unquote ghost candidates was coming from consultants working for Florida Power and Light, Florida Crystals, and Mosaic. But other readers of other papers might not be seeing that sort of thing. And so I wanted to get to a point where I could work across silos. And that's part of what prompted me to become an independent journalist. And so, you know, let me
just jump in here to remind people, you know, in today's media landscape where we see these media organizations paying Donald Trump millions and millions of dollars or Jeff Bezos, who owns The Washington Post, paying $40 million for a Melania documentary and things like that. You know, the value of independent journalism is just, you know, what they say, a price greater than rubies, right? So, you know. Here's Jason. He's supported by his readers. Here's WMNF. We're supported solely by our listeners. We get no money from any government entity anymore. Nothing. No grants. No government support whatsoever. No corporate support. We are completely non-commercial. Jason is completely non-commercial. I mean, really, who can you trust? You can trust independent media, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we've, as you pointed out, we're seeing a lot of the downsides now to the corporate consolidation that's happened on sort of the mainstream media level. And yeah, independent journalism it's clearly the future, right? And one of the things we've been able to do with my Substack is we built a pretty significant subscriber base of like. You know, there's quite a number of Republican lawmakers that are subscribers to our Substack. So like we're able to get information in front of people, in addition to everybody, also in front of decision makers to sort of make it harder for them to ignore. Like, for instance, there was a really controversial piece of legislation this year that would have essentially made it easier for the largest landowners in Florida to build city-sized developments without any local input, right, on rural tracts of land. And we were able to sort of expose that it was this law was coming from this New York investment firm that had amassed more than 80,000 acres of rural land.
Is that the one that had secretly Patrick Zalupski behind it?
No. You're thinking of the land swap. The DeSantis administration's attempted land swap with Guano River.
Well, I've got to cut us off now just to. Yeah. Be able to ask you very quickly, is there anything you can tell us you're working on now or what we should keeping an eye on very quickly?
Yeah, we're working right now. We're digging deeper into the budget ahead of the budget special session. We've also started to pull some records on different special interests that were involved in this legislative session. So I'm working on some stuff related to, you know, Philip Morris to car dealers, which are sort of a personal rent seeking ballywick of mine. So we've got lots coming. And then obviously, you know, as election season kicks up, following the money in campaigns will become a big part of what we're focused on.
Right. All right. Well, listeners, you know, you can follow all the stuff that Jason's working on by looking at his Substack and hopefully subscribing to Seeking Rents. Jason's also got a podcast. If you're a podcast listener, you can find Seeking Rents on all your podcast platforms. But that's a wrap for us, friends. We are pretty much out of time now. I'm really grateful to Jason Garcia for keeping us up to date on all the wheeling and dealing in the state legislature and for all of his investigative work that breaks big stories about Florida corruption and special interests. You can find more of Jason's work on Seeking Rents, not behind a paywall, but your subscription helps keep him working for us. So I want to thank my WMNF volunteers also, Jessica Green on the soundboard, who gets us on the air, and Daria Miranova, who's answered the phone and helps as a show assistant here, all volunteers, as am I. Now stay tuned for Talking Animals after the NPR News and Mario and Joe with the conversation at noon. Thanks for listening. Come back next week. We are WMNF Tampa.
Those that got the answers.
Hey, that was great.
Red tape, get in the way.